From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Ben Dieter, an assistant producer in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Michael Mandelbaum. He's the author of a new book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, which examines the 25 years of deep peace experienced around the world from 1989 to 2014. According to Mandelbaum, the fall of the Berlin Wall signaled the beginning of a reign of peace around the world. The period saw the geopolitical dominance and leadership of the United States, the growth of economic interdependence across the world, and the spread of democracy to places that had scarcely seen it. Michael Mandelbaum, a preeminent foreign policy scholar, examines that quarter century and describes how and why the peace was established and then fell apart. According to Mandelbaum, this era of peace was undone by one important country in each region: Vladimir Putin's Russia in Europe, Xi Jinping's China in Asia, and the theocratic Iranian regime in the Middle East. They all implemented aggressive nationalist policies aimed at overturning the prevailing political arrangements in their respective regions. The three had a common motive: their need to survive in a democratic age with their country's prospects for economic growth uncertain. Mandelbaum further argues that the key to the return of peace lies in the advent of genuine democracy, including free elections and the protection of religious, economic, and political liberty. Michael Mandelbaum is the Christian A. Herter Professor Emeritus of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington. He previously taught at Harvard University, Columbia University, and the U.S. Naval Academy. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of 16 books. We had the privilege of interviewing him several years ago about his book entitled In Democracy's Good Name. Professor Mandelbaum joins us now at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his newest book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. Professor Mandelbaum, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you and your audience.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Ben Dieter.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, Professor, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
What prompted you to write it?
I had written a book that I published 3 years ago called Mission Failure, America and the World in the Post-Cold War Era. And I covered the 25 years of the post-Cold War era from the American point of view. This book goes over the same period, but looks at it from a global point of view. The book is not mainly about the United States, but about these three contested regions, Europe, East Asia, and the Middle East. So I think of the rise and fall of peace on Earth as being a complement to Mission Failure, which was published in 2016.
So in the new book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, you discuss three main causes of the peace between 1989, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and 2014. How would you summarize them?
The first of these causes is the benign hegemony of the United States. The United States far surpassed any other country in power, and even those countries that weren't all that happy about America being the big guy on the block didn't feel they were in a position to challenge the United States in any serious way. The second peace-promoting feature was economic interdependence. This was, after all, one of the great ages of globalization. Countries that trade with and invest in each other on a large scale are reluctant to go to war with each other because it costs them money. And then democracy is the third peace-promoting feature. And by democracy, incidentally, I mean a combination of two things. One is popular sovereignty, that is free, fair, and regular elections. But democracy also involves liberty, that is economic liberty, private property, religious liberty, freedom of worship, and political liberty, the rights embodied in the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution. And democracy promotes peace in a variety of ways. Now, I have to add that these three peace-promoting features, individually or even together, do not guarantee peace. nothing can guarantee peace. There are no laws of international politics like the laws of physics. So I think we can think of these three peace-promoting features as modular blocks which, when placed one on top of the other, create a formidable, well, let's not call it a wall, let's call it a barrier against war. And that's what we had in the 25 years after 1989.
So to continue our conversation, let me turn to Ben Dieter for a question.
Thanks, Carol. So, Professor Mandelbaum, what were some of the defining moments during and after 2014 where your window of deep peace ends? And what was the common denominator among the three revisionist countries in Russia, China, and Iran?
Perhaps the most dramatic moment demarcating the end of the post-Cold War era and the deep peace that I believe obtained during the post-Cold War era was the Russian invasion and occupation of Ukraine. This was the first time that a government had crossed a sovereign border against the wishes of the government of the country whose border was crossed in Europe since the 1930s. So it was really quite a landmark event. In East Asia, I would say that the signal event was the coming to power in China of Xi Jinping. He came to power before 2014, but by 2014 it became clear that he intended to carry out a much more aggressive policy than did his predecessors since Mao Zedong. In the Middle East, well, the Middle East is a little bit different. It was never as peaceful as the other two, because whereas Europe had the three peace-promoting features that I identify in the rise and fall of peace on Earth, including at least for a while democracy, because Russia in the 1990s embarked on a democratic course, and East Asia had two of the peace-promoting features. It had benign American hegemony and economic interdependence, although not democracy, because China was never a democracy. In the Middle East, only one of these peace-promoting features was present, namely American hegemony. There was no democracy, there was no economic interdependence, so the peace was far less sturdy in the Middle East. And what happened was that the American presence in the Middle East weakened, partly because of the Iraq War and the disappointment that that caused in the United States, leading to a lesser willingness to play a robust role in the region. And that gave Iran, which had never accepted the American hegemony and had always, at least since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution, aspired to dominate the region, that gave Iran the opportunity to conduct more aggressive policies.
So, Professor Mandelbaum, I have a question related to the events that you outlined during and after 2014. Do you think the United States, through its policies or perhaps inaction, helped to facilitate these trends? And let me give you an example. Remember, President Obama failed to enforce a red line in Syria when chemical weapons were used by Bashar al-Assad on his own population. Some interpret that as having given a so-called green light for Putin to invade and annex Crimea and mess around in eastern Ukraine. And also, for example, 2009, President Obama didn't defend the Green Movement, that democracy movement in Iran. Some say failing to do that and pursuing at all costs the nuclear deal with Iran might have been misguided. And then with regard to China, we had the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that might have thwarted China's rise, and then that fell apart.
Well, I think all of the episodes that you mentioned were less than helpful in preserving the peace. In The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, I identify one crucial mistake that I think had a very widespread negative effect, and that was the decision by the Clinton administration to expand the Atlantic Alliance, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, up to the borders of Russia against Russia's wishes, contrary to promises that had been made both to Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin that this would not happen, and with the assurance that all countries were welcome to join NATO except Russia. This, I think, had a very unfortunate effect because it followed by a number of other measures that the Russians felt were inimical to their interests, had the effect of turning the Russian political elite and the Russian people against the West and the United States. It made them reflexively anti-American in foreign policy. And that meant that when Mr. Putin decided to invade Ukraine, in order, as I argue in the book, to shore up his own political position and generate popularity, he knew that he could succeed. He knew that it would be popular for him to invade Ukraine because he portrayed it as a way of resisting an aggressive American measure to take over Ukraine and further isolate Russia. Now, the claim that Putin made about what the United States and the West were doing in Ukraine is false. But he was able to sell it to the Russian people because they were predisposed to think of the United States and the West that way because of NATO expansion. So that's the one policy that, had it not taken place, might have made a serious difference. As for China, well, China has become more aggressive in part because it's become more powerful, and it's become more powerful because of its remarkable economic growth. So in theory, it might have been possible to constrain China by trying to restrict its economic growth, but I don't think that that was ever politically feasible. I don't think the United States was ever going to adopt a course that would seek to prevent China's remarkable double-digit annual growth, nor, if the United States had done so, would other countries have gone along. So I think it's very difficult to see how the problems in East Asia could have been prevented, because they're based not only on the need of the communist regime for a means to generate popularity when the growth rate has been cut in half, but these aggressive policies are also based on very deeply rooted Chinese nationalism that any government of China would respond to. And as for Iran, some of the episodes that you mentioned have not been helpful in containing Iran. And I would add the nuclear deal in 2015, which in my view did not take advantage of the leverage that the United States and the rest of the world had, and could have been much tougher and made us much more secure. But I believe that the impulse to dominate the region is really built into the DNA, the political DNA of the Islamic Republic. And there was really nothing we could do to get that regime to be more interested in cooperating with its neighbors than in dominating them.
Of course, these are historical ifs. We'll never know. And I didn't mean to suggest that the United States could have necessarily changed the course, but perhaps affected some change. With respect to NATO expansion, as you know, there's quite a bit of controversy over that. We had Angela Stent here, an expert on Russia, about her book on Putin's world, and she would dispute your argument that the NATO expansion was key to Putin's subsequent actions. But again, that's just another point of contention. We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Michael Mandelbaum, Professor Emeritus of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington. He's the author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. I'm Carol Castiel, along with assistant producer Ben Dieter. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Kabul, Afghanistan, Hezbollah Esahil. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now I'd like to turn to Ben Dieter for another question.
Thanks, Carol. So, Professor Mandelbaum, some would read your book and maybe contest your notion that we had deep peace post-Cold War from 1989 to 2014, pointing to conflicts such as the Gulf War or the invasion of Iraq or the drama in the Balkans. So I'm curious, what are you defining as peace in the book, and then how do those smaller conflicts fit into that definition?
We had a deeper peace than ever before, not because there was no violence, there certainly was, but the violence was generally confined to civil wars or militias persecuting people under their control and did not involve clashes of the most powerful states using their armed forces that had the most powerful of weapons. And that kind of conflict, war between and among the so-called great powers, is historically by far the greatest cause of death and destruction in the world. And not only was there no great power war, the most powerful states were generally not much interested in going to war. There was no imminent threat of war. Countries did not have to conduct their foreign policies looking over their shoulders at the possibility that there would be serious armed conflict. I once saw a sign, a no parking sign, that said, "Don't even think of parking here." Well, during this period of deep peace, the most powerful countries weren't really thinking seriously about going to war. War had fallen, perhaps not entirely off their agendas, but to a much lower point on their public agendas than at any time before. And that's the sense in which I mean that this golden quarter century was unusually peaceful.
Professor Mandelbaum, you say in your book that democracy is a powerful antidote to armed conflict and that it fosters peace, even if, as you said earlier, it doesn't guarantee peace. What about it helps keep the peace?
Democracy promotes peace in a variety of ways. Let me note just two of them. Popular sovereignty gives the public a means of checking and restraining its occasionally bellicose leaders. Moreover, democracy can be thought of as a political system for resolving conflicts peacefully. There are many conflicts in democracies, just as there are conflicts in any human society, but what is distinctive about democracy is a powerful commitment to work out those conflicts without resorting to force, and that's what democracies do. Many studies have shown that, at least in the modern period, democracies have a tendency, a pretty powerful and pronounced tendency, not to go to war, at least not with one another.
I have a follow-up question. You also say in the book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, that the road to peace on Earth runs, as we said, through popular sovereignty and liberty, and that only if Russia, China, and Iran adopted democracy, things would be different. But really, what are the chances that those three countries would truly adopt democracy?
Democracy in Russia, China, and Iran would spell the demise of the current regimes, and that's why the current regimes will resist it and do resist it as powerfully as they can. I don't know when or indeed whether democracy will come to one or two or all three of these countries. It certainly doesn't seem likely to happen overnight, and that's why I have said in The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth that the message of the book is both optimistic and pessimistic. We have both good news and bad news. The good news is we have a formula for peace. The bad news is we really don't know how to apply it. But I do make clear in the last chapter of the book that there are democratic currents, democratic forces, democratic sentiments in all three of these countries, and they occasionally come to the surface. We don't see them because in each of these countries, the dictatorship represses dissenting activity. But we know that these sentiments are there. Then we know that there are Russians, Chinese, and Iranians who are not satisfied with the dictatorships that govern them and would like a different and perhaps a democratic form of government. Whether these forces will ever succeed in transforming these countries, we simply don't know. What I think we can be fairly confident of is that if these countries are transformed into democracies, it will be done by the people of these countries themselves. It won't happen by outside intervention.
To continue on the discussion of the three regimes themselves, you said that each of them played on nationalism to really propel their agendas domestically, and then now we're seeing internationally. Why is that strategy particularly effective and in such different places and different countries?
It seems to have worked, or at least these regimes think it will work, because nationalism is in the modern era roughly beginning with the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century, nationalism is the most powerful political sentiment. It's a proven winner. And these three regimes present their policies, their aggressive policies, in ways that are particularly appealing to nationalist sentiment. They present their policies not as aggressive as they are, but as defensive. They present them as policies necessary to protect the nation, Russia, China, or Persia, against what they depict as the rapacious designs of the West and the United States to weaken and even destroy them. So what Mr. Putin, Mr. Xi, and the Iranian mullahs say to their people is, the nation is in danger and we are protecting you. And that's a pretty powerful appeal if it is convincing. And as far as we know, at least to some extent, it is convincing.
Professor Mandelbaum, you said that democracy can't be imposed from the outside, that these three countries in particular need to develop or cultivate democracy from within. But nonetheless, to the extent that the United States is an example of democracy and has promoted democracy rhetorically and through some programs over the years, do you think that we're moving away from the U.S. policies and postures that preserved and encouraged peace during the 25-year post-Cold War era, particularly in this era of Donald Trump? You mentioned nationalism. We're seeing strains of nationalism. We're actually going, some critics would argue, in the opposite direction of what you have recommended. Immigration, free trade, democracy used to be the cornerstones that buttressed U.S. national security policies, and some of those concepts are coming into question.
I don't think we've had any serious success in actively promoting democracy. After all, there are places that we actually occupy, Haiti, for example, or Iraq, where democracy did not take firm root. And that's because democracy has preconditions. It requires experiences, attitudes, values, institutions, and these take time to form. But democracy does spread by example. And so in order to promote democracy, it is incumbent on the United States to be the best form of democracy that we can be, the most attractive form. Although I should also add that it doesn't really depend exclusively, perhaps not even mainly, on the United States. Democracy spread remarkably in the last quarter of the 20th century, because there were lots of democracies to imitate. The Eastern Europeans, when they freed themselves from communism and opted for democracy, did so not really because of the United States, but because of the example of Western Europe.
No, they did it because of the Voice of America.
Well,
just
yes, the Voice of America is certainly not irrelevant, and the Voice of America told them what was going on in Western Europe as well as in the United States. And I would make one other point here. Since we now face three disturbers of the peace in three crucial regions of the world, I think that in order to protect democracy where it exists and to preserve the possibility of its spreading, the United States ought to revive in suitably adjusted form the Cold War policy of containment. During the Cold War, the United States and its allies resisted the military initiatives and political designs of the Soviet Union, and carried into the 21st century, that would mean doing the same toward Russia, China, and Iran. And in order to do that, we need to have allies. We need to form coalitions. And that doesn't seem to be at the top of the current administration's agenda, although, to be fair, the previous administration wasn't particularly committed to it either. And in the end, the question of whether the United States will help organize these coalitions or reaffirm them and engage in a policy of containing Russia, China, and Iran really depends on the American people. Presidential leadership is important, but ultimately any policy of this sort has to rest on the support of the American public.
Let me turn to Ben for another question.
Yeah, if I might follow up on what you just said, Professor Mandelbaum. If we were to adopt such a containment strategy toward Russia, Iran, and China, what would we need to do to prevent another foreign policy misstep like the one that we saw in Vietnam? I think that people would point to that as the prime misstep of our original policy of containment. So how would we operate in a different way to ensure something like that doesn't happen again?
Well, to avoid Vietnam, we could simply avoid land wars in Asia. I don't think that that's very likely, in part because the Cold War was a contest with the Soviet Union and international communism that was seen to be behind aggressive moves everywhere, and there were communist parties everywhere. That's not true now. This is not a global conflict. It's three regional conflicts, and it's not an ideological conflict. There's no equivalent of communism. The more recent war that has proven unpopular and is for most Americans a cautionary lesson in what not to do was the war in Iraq. And I think that if we avoid such nation-building or nation-transforming exercises, we can avoid what most Americans found least attractive about America's post-Cold War foreign policy and what turned out to be the costliest and least productive aspects of that foreign policy.
Professor Mandelbaum, we're witnessing a resurgence of, one could say, the Arab Spring point two with the events in Sudan, Algeria. We shall see how that plays out. But in general, how can we help peace rise again like it did in that 25-year post-Cold War period? You say there's room for optimism. There's also some pessimism as we go forward. But as we see a rise in populism, a rightward political shift that foments illiberal democracy at best and autocracy at worst, how do you see the future, the next few years at least?
I don't have a crystal ball. I do think that democracy in the democracies is relatively robust. I don't worry about democracy disappearing. And I don't see populist movements either in Europe or in the United States as being necessarily anti-democratic. In fact, these populist movements are being incorporated into the political system and are competing in elections according to democratic rules. Now, one may not like the policies they espouse, but they have the right to espouse them as long as they go about it peacefully. So I don't find democracy in the democracies to be as shaky as some people do. But I don't know, as I've said, when or indeed whether democracy will come to the three disturbers of the peace, because that is what would make the world considerably more peaceful. And I don't think we have the power to bring it about. And therefore, what the United States and its democratic allies can do is at least contain the aggressive policies of the three powers. Foreign policy in general, I think, doesn't make the world a better place, but it can keep it from becoming a worse place. And I think that's the task of American foreign policy.
The book is The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. The author, Michael Mandelbaum. Professor Mandelbaum, congratulations once again on your book. We hope our listeners will look for it and purchase it. And thank you for coming in and sharing your keen insights.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. And joining me on the program was Ben Dieter. He's assistant producer in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.